KCSU-FM Stanford. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining today on the show. Today I'm very excited to have on Dean Ann Balsamo of the New School, author of the book Designing Culture, The Technological Imagination at Work. This is a book that I came across a couple of years ago, but it's a work that I keep coming back to. Ann has written in large measure, although not exclusively, a first-person account of the field of creating new media, and specifically the kinds of visual and oral and written displays that create what she calls our culture. And it's a culture that we're going to talk about in detail today. When we think about the design of media, it's something that crosses into a variety of areas that we discuss on Hearsay Culture. Obviously, as someone that teaches law and writes in law, one of my areas and perhaps my strongest interest is how the law can help or hinder the innovative process. And so I focused my career on internet policy and intellectual property law more specifically. Ann comes at this from a very different perspective, where she's talking about how culture is made, taking culture, as she writes, seriously, not only from a design and development perspective, but particularly in the interest of Hearsay Culture, from an innovation perspective. What is it that we can do as a society, not only to encourage this kind of innovation, but how does that innovation take place? And so in Designing Culture, the subtitle is quite important, The Technological Imagination at Work. We are going to spend time today on the show talking about a variety of areas that Anne writes about and theorizes about in her book, ranging from the labor associated with creating these works to literally how technology and innovation fit together in our broad conception of culture. And in that conversation, we're going to move through several areas that Anne writes about, including the reading wall, a fascinating media display that she writes about and spent a good amount of time on, and work our way from there. It's an area, like I said, of strong interest to me, not only through Hearsay Culture, but also with my work at Elon, as we have an iMedia program and one that I'm increasingly involved with and that I am a fan of. And so I'm excited to have Ann on today. By way of very brief background, she is a prolific writer and leader in this field. She has a PhD in communications research from the University of Illinois. She began her career at Georgia Tech, spent quite a number of years at the University of Southern California. She was also involved at the, and it is indeed a legendary innovation center, Xerox PARC, and I will ask you a few questions about that as well, leading to her current position, where she is the dean of the School of Media Studies and a professor of media studies at the New School for Public Engagement, a school that I have been familiar with since I was a kid, and a school whose authors and scholars I've had on the show from time to time, including Ken Wark a few years ago. Ann is joining us from her loft in Manhattan via Skype, and I am thrilled to have her on today, February 26th. Ann, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Hi, Dave. It's just great to finally connect up with you. I'm glad to have this chance to have opportunity to talk about some stuff in the book.
Terrific. Thank you so much, Ann, for working with me through the schedule this year. Let's start off, Ann, with a question that I ask most of my guests, and many people will be familiar with your work, but perhaps you could talk a bit more about your background and why you wrote this book.
So I have a background in cultural studies, which is an interdisciplinary domain of research and scholarship that really kind of coalesced in the last kind of 50 years or so. And I crossed cultural studies with a background in feminist theory, and then focused that kind of combination of feminist cultural studies onto the topic of the cultural implications of emergent technologies. So I was trained in my doctoral program, which was itself an interdisciplinary program, in the area that I call Feminist Cultural Studies of Emergent Technologies. This was, from every angle, an interdisciplinary endeavor. requiring and leading me to get kind of background in a variety of fields, mostly in the fields of humanities. So it would be like literary theory, anthropology, interpretive sociology, history of technology, philosophy of technology, philosophy and history of medicine, and then the kind of philosophy and history of feminist kind of thinking. So my background is this kind of interdisciplinary, cross-disciplinary melange of humanities kind of areas of research and scholarship, where the focus was for me, from kind of an early age as a graduate student, the focus was on how do we make sense of new technologies when they are coming to us in their kind of, in their newness. So as a technology kind of enters the scene of culture, which happens and has been happening with increasing frequency over the last three decades, how do we, scholars, critical thinkers, analysts, how do we make sense of the impact of these technologies before they actually play themselves out? So this area that I've been kind of looking at for, again, you know, for my 25 years in the field is, you know, how do you make sense of technologies in their moment of emergence before they've, you know, had kind of many, you know, many impacts, like either, you know, positive impacts or you know, undesirable impacts. But the reason I was interested in technologies in their kind of moment of emergence is because I wanted to really wrestle with the fact, or wrestle with the question of how could you intervene in technologies and their intended impacts so that they would have more liberatory impacts rather than undesirable impacts. So it was always from the beginning a kind of a politically motivated project of how could we really wrestle with technologies to have them serve the broader needs of a culture or to serve more democratic ends, and how and at what point in the kind of trajectory of technology development is it possible to do that?
Yeah, and that gets to a good introductory question, because when we think about the internet, right, there's a lot of writing or increasing amount of writing about the founding of the internet, as it were, and the values that were theoretically baked into the architecture. I guess my question for you boils down to how much of what happens at the emergence of a technology, in your view, is serendipitous versus intentional? Because there's a lot of that discussion, particularly around the internet and around new media, and so I know that this is a broad question, but in your experience, do you find that the creators of technology have in fact baked into the emergence of the technology the values that eventually are ascribed to that technology later?
Right, that's a great question, and let me see if I can unpack it a bit, because it's at the heart of the concept that I describe as the technological imagination.
Mm-hmm.
So if we think about the scene of technology development, and you can take that scene and kind of sculpt it in different ways. Let's imagine a group of engineering researchers who share a lab space. So we're going to take that most institutionalized kind of form of technology development. They are a group of people who come with different backgrounds, and they are getting together to, you know, to embark on, you know, an innovative process. They want to create something new. They want to experiment with various materials and, you know, and follow through on a set of what if questions. What if this technology could do this? And what would we need to do to enable our, you know, our technologies to do this? And, you know, so they are a group of human beings coming together to explore what is at that moment a highly kind of speculative set of possibilities. And those speculative, yeah, that set of possibilities could be the most rationally arrived at. Like, well, our theoretical work suggests that we should be able to do this. And so we're going to explore that if indeed we manage all the contingencies, we do get this result. So they, those speculations could be highly rational, or they could be highly science fictional. You know, like, what if we suspended the laws of gravity? What kind of machine would we need to develop to do something or to enable us to levitate or so on and so forth?
Uh-huh.
So, you know, that scene of development, of technology development, is crisscrossed by lots of different forces. And here's where we get at the kind of complexity that I'm trying to unpack. That scene is never kind of always under the rational kind of understanding of the human beings who are in that room. That, you know, that scene is not always going to be so determinable that someone is going to know at every stage what could happen, what will happen, and what should happen. That scene is going to be, in some respects, this moment of opportunity when something that wasn't already known becomes possible. That's the scene of experimentation. That's the scene of, you know, speculation, of wild spontaneity or improvisation. That is the scene that really draws a lot of people into the acts of, you know, of technological experimentation. But that scene is also not entirely up for grabs. That scene is very subtly already determined in interesting ways. It's already determined, or it's already shaped by the nature of the questions that are being asked of the technology, the nature of the technology itself at the base level of materials, the fact that materials have different properties that are non-negotiable. So think about just raw materials being, you know, having different properties of conductivity, of melting, of being able to be shaped, of being able to be reworked. So that scene of experimentation and invention, and indeed the scene that will structure innovation, that scene is itself kind of a mixture of things that are already actually already there, already baked into it, and a scene that also is open to possibilities and unexpected outcomes and improvisational encounters.
You know, and that's, and you know, and this gets us to your concept of design and culture, and this also this concept of reverse engineering, which I want to talk about. But to push a little further on that point, you know, do we as, you know, and think about this from a policy making or a rule making perspective, and I recognize, of course, you're not an attorney, and I'm not asking about the law,
right,
to be clear. But my, the question is this, you know, we tend to talk a lot about the values inherent in technology. And I think we put a lot of value, and pun intended, and import into it. Are we or do we overstate, in your view, in our discussions of technology and what they are and what they should be, do we put too much stock in what the inventors, what the people with the, you know, with the often fanciful eureka moment thought about the technology? Or should we put more value in the fact that technologies can and do change? Do you have a broad perspective on how we read or how much import we put into that early stage question of values?
Well, I think that the discussion about the and focus on, you know, where do values and at what point do values kind of get baked into a technological possibility. What we know is that inventors can have intentions, and they can hope, you know, hope to bake in certain values and certain capacities and certain capabilities for a particular technology kind of under development. But they themselves are imperfect, kind of, you know, imperfect creators in that. They can't guarantee that that technology that does eventually get created or assembled, that that technology will perfectly carry their values kind of forward.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of those things where we can neither over kind of rely on it by saying, well, those were good people and they had great values and they intended, you know, this technology to have great liberatory potential. We can neither kind of rely on that as being the place where the value gets baked in, nor can we ignore it. It's like that's good and that does have some determining influence. But in fact, it is also the way in which technologies get taken up and how they get shaped over time that determines the values that then in turn get carried along with them. So your point about policy and law and protocols are, you know, are absolutely critical. It's like no matter how liberatory I as an inventor may want to be in the, you know, in the moment that I am bringing something into existence, when that thing that we call a technology gets taken up and it gets duplicated and replicated and reproduced over time, and it gets reworked in new situations, in new contexts, and so on, things will get reproduced with it that are about the kind of the broader value kind of incubation process. Things, for example, that I may not have intended in the first place. So an example is I could create a communication system that enables me to communicate via internets with another, you know, human being, and that protocol is very, you know, very lightweight and exciting and easy to use and fun to use and limits me to 140 characters, and I invent a new kind of communication genre called the short impulse kind of internet missive. And so on. And over time, and very shortly, some imagination is going to want to take that and say, how can I use this for connecting, you know, sellers and clients? How am I going to use this for, facilitating economic relations? How am I going to use this? And I'll tell you, you know, for facilitating sexual hookups. How am I going to use mm-hmm. this for facilitating, kind of other critical, you know, pain points that we need, like, you know, lost children and parents,
mm-hmm.
animals and their lost owners and so on. So, you know, I can invent something that intervenes, that does something different. And as soon as it's kind of out of the box or out of the bag, it's going to get taken up, and it's going to get taken up to do other things than what I had intended. And that also is a way in which the thing, the technology, kind of whatever it is you want to call that object ensemble of things, that's another way in which that thing, that technology, gets value baked into it.
We're chatting with Ann Balsamo, author of the book Designing Culture, The Technological Imagination at Work, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. And let's talk, and that question of values, of course, ties directly into, I think, one of the main points that you make in your book Designing Culture. In order to get into a few of the points you make in the book, perhaps you could give us that general definition of culture and what you mean by designing it?
Good question. So the term culture for me, again, comes out of a particular scholarly tradition that, you know, cultural studies, that takes culture to be kind of the whole way of life, the way in which human beings live their lives on a daily basis that provides meaning for a whole range of human activities. So, you know, culture is what we call it, the broadest, a whole way of life. It is also the name for the webs of significance within which we live our lives and we create a life that has meaning. So culture is the kind of domain of meaning making, and the way in which people create meaning in the engagement with other people, with tools, with habits, with and through practices, and through kind of their engagements with kind of different forces that structure human life. Designing culture is something that happens kind of on a daily basis, both at the very micro level. I am the designer, in some respects, of my own kind of cultural existence, from the identity I perform as a woman, as a scholar, as a woman of a particular age, as a person who lives in a particular nation. So I design a kind of a set of meanings that embody my identity, my meaningfulness. And I also participate in the design of a broader sense of culture in a more anthropological sense. I participate in, in the enactment of consumer culture by virtue of my consumption habits, by what I buy, what I look at, the audiences I participate as. So designing culture for me is this practice that I'm trying to understand better. Like, who designs culture? And how do we understand the process whereby culture gets designed so that we could reflect on what culture do we want to live in? And what culture do I aspire to leave or to create as a foundation for the future, such that the choices I make of cultural kind of making, that those choices can result in a kind of culture that I would be happy to leave as my legacy, or I would be happy to kind of bring forward for future generations as the foundations for their culture making in the future.
Yeah, it's interesting. You and one of the themes in the book, which is an interesting one that I want to mention now since you brought it up, is this concept of the legacy. And legacy is being a part of thinking through how culture is designed. You mentioned a recurring dream, and in the epilogue of your book that I want to ask you about, and it's one I think that anyone who is in the classroom, or who has ever taught, would resonate, with. So can you tell that story and how it ties into your thoughts about writing a book about this new culture?
So in the recurring dream, I'm in a large, cavernous classroom, and I know it's a classroom because there are students milling about. I just know they're there. And I'm in the classroom, and I don't know exactly where I am because I don't actually get the architecture. If I'm on the stage and they're in an auditorium, I just know it's a big cavernous space. And there are people there who I know are students, but I don't know what they look like. And I'm trying to communicate with them. And in the dream, the recurring dream, I end up screaming, and not out of anger, and not with evil intent. I just start screaming because I'm trying to get them to listen to me, and I want them. And and the dream has had this weird changing inflection. I used to dream that the students were women and young women that would have been at classroom age. And that I'm screaming about technologies. You need to learn about technologies, and these are important. And what would you design, or what would you make, or what kind of technology? So and my voice gets louder and louder and louder. And then the shift was from seeing women or getting the sense of female students to getting a sense of engineering students, maybe mostly male, but again, the dream was kind of, and then I'm screaming that culture's important. What would it mean? What is culture? What do you think about culture? When do you think about, so the dream is me going hoarse. And I wake up in the mornings with this kind of metaphorical hoarse voice about trying to be heard in a cavernous room where my voice is being absorbed just by the volume of the space. Yet I know there are people there who are also straining to listen to me. So it's not a kind of hopelessness of a dream. It's about I can't make my voice big enough in this cavernous space to be heard, and their ears can't be big enough in this cavernous space to hear me. So they get this muffled, the muffled kind of sense on both sides. That's why I wrote the book.
to overcome the sense that there was no clear way to get the message across.
Yeah. To go back to the mechanism we have, even in a digital age, to put the ideas into some material form as a cultural artifact. And that's what I take the book to be. It is a cultural artifact born of a particular techno-cultural moment, having its own kind of, renaissance and reimagination now in a digital age. But it is an enduring cultural form right now that allows me to put ideas there and express ideas. And it has expressive capabilities that in fact allow me to even comment and reflect on its own expressive possibilities, to put it there so that it will be on a bookshelf for a while till its pages to disintegrate back into, to dust, to allow me to kind of stop being so anxious that I'm not getting the ideas out or down. The ideas are there in this artifact as best as I could craft it. It will go on the shelf, and I actually imagine where in the great bookshelf of the imaginary bookshelf of the world, where does this book live, and who are my shelf mates into perpetuity? Who's on my left and who's on my right? And I got to tell you, as a scholar, I'm in very good company for that bookshelf into perpetuity and where these ideas will live until the book itself no longer gets reproduced and reimagined and downloaded and then uploaded into new, cultural forms.
Well, I've got to ask you, since you said, who is in your imagination on your left and on your right in that celestial, if you will, bookshelf?
So I imagine the book living on a bookshelf with the works of other feminist scholars of science and technology. So let's just say if I could be anywhere in the proximity of Donna Haraway, that would be an amazing place to be for the life of that book, because her work has been so, so important to me, along with some other very important and deep feminist thinkers like Karen Berard and Lucy Suchman, in particular. So, I would be very happy for the book to live there. I also would be happy if the book could live in proximity, for example, to anything that Sherry Turkle has done, mm-hmm. and anything that Bruce Sterling has done. His book on the Internet of Things has been amazing. And then there are key people in science technology studies who also, I think, really help us think more complexly about the nature of technology. So if I could be on that bookshelf with the kind of science technology studies people, that would be pretty cool.
I think it's good positioning. And we're going to take a break in a second here, but when you think about that, recurring dream and positioning. You know, my recurring dream is basically, and I think it's perhaps because I'm earlier in my career and still thinking through the best way to get information across in the classroom. My situation is simply that over the course of a class, my dream is I just lose control of the class. People start walking out, people leave, people start throwing things at me, and by the end of the class, the class of 50 is down to 3 people who are there at a sympathy, and whatever I can try to do to get them to stay in the room, they don't, and they don't care. And so it's very interesting because, as I think about my writing, it is that effort to attempt to get down on paper what hopefully will be a document of the work I do. And I think it's a dream and a concept that I think resonates with many academics. You're listening to KZSU FM Stanford Hearsay Culture. Today's guest, Dean Ann Balsamo of the New School for Public Engagement, Dean of the New School of Media Studies, and author of the book Designing Culture, The Technological Imagination at Work. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that we are on KZSU FM, which is a non-commercial and non-profit radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. Indeed, it requires donations to continue having a one-hour long-form interview format. For those of you that are interested in making a donation to Hearsay Culture, you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, and you will get a happy response, or you can go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I do hope you continue listening to the station and to other public radio stations. So, and let's dive in the latter half of the interview, roughly, into some of the concepts that you talk about in the book. And again, you mentioned it, the book concept, and I want to come back to it because one of the projects that you spend a good amount of time on writing about and also experienced is the reading wall, which I think is a wonderful concept and analogy to the kinds of cultural values you're writing about. Perhaps you could tell us a bit about the reading wall and how that ties into the thesis and the goals of the book.
Mm-hmm. I'd be happy to. So the reading wall was one of 15 exhibits that a group of us built for a museum exhibit called Experiments in the Future of Reading. And so this was a museum exhibit created by a group called RED, Research and Experimental Documents, that a group that was at Xerox PARC, and the museum exhibit we built was on kind of on display and on tour from about 1999, 2000, till about 2003. The reading wall is a very large exhibit. It consisted of 3 very long wall segments, and these were wall segments that were freestanding as part of the overall museum exhibit. And each wall segment had a monitor hung on the wall, and the experience a visitor would have with this particular interactive was to drag the monitor kind of along the wall, the monitor being on rails, and as a visitor would move the monitor on the rails along the wall, various episodes in the history of the development of reading and writing would be revealed. So the idea was a kind of digital magic lens, the monitor. You moved it along a timeline that's printed on the wall, and when you got to a particular moment in the timeline that says, okay, right here, this is the moment of the discovery of the Rosetta Stone, and the timeline, which is very linear and so on, that's printed on the wall, just has a tick mark with Rosetta Stone discovered on it. The display at that position along the wall would show and reveal a kind of dynamically created episode talking about the significance of the Rosetta Stone. You know, how was it discovered? Who was it discovered by? what was its historical, you know, conditions of creation, and what is its value to us as we now think about the long history of reading and writing. So the Reading Wall was created as a kind of monumental experience to demonstrate how important it is that we think about and understand the history of the development of writing, and then of reading, and then of broader communication forms. Because those practices, the practices of reading, of writing, and of communication, are the foundational practices that create culture and are the foundations of human civilization. So we used the monumental kind of scale of long walls with, you know, tall kind of, you know, a tall kind of footprint or a tall kind of shape to communicate that this history of reading, writing, and communication is an incredibly important history for humankind. That was the design kind of intent for this, to create a monumental experience communicating the importance of the history of reading, writing, and communication in the middle of an exhibition that was all about the future of reading and how reading's going to change in the future as new technologies develop.
You know, it's interesting because you focus in the book and you talk about your interest in the nuts and bolts, the labor of putting these kinds of iMedia and new media exhibits together. And I do want to ask you about that interest because, you know, to me it is akin to the kinds of questions I ask early in my interviews about why people write books and how they come to do this work. Talk a bit about the labor associated with creating this culture and your views on the role of human beings in creating this kind of culture.
Well, I mean, human beings are the foundational creators of all culture, but they are not the only creators of culture. And they create culture in deep conversation with other kinds of agents and indeed other species, right? I mean, so we understand that there is a human animal culture that is not the same all over the world, and is very much a kind of a part and a consequence of human practices that develop over time that put people in different kinds of relationships with animals. We also create culture in conversation with elements of the material world, you know, in discussion and exploration and experimentation with, you know, material, raw materials, and then with built materials and then built technologies and so on. So when I think about the labor of making culture, you know, I think about it as something that both happens almost without thought, like every day in our consumption habits and via the traces of the way we live our lives, you know, and increasingly now the traces of the places I've visited on various networks, my carbon footprint that I leave, you know, as I kind of I move around the world through a car, through mass transit, and so on. Culture is both something that I create kind of unintentionally just by my practice and my habits of living, but it's also something increasingly that everybody is engaged in with a lot of forethought. So I think about like the rise of makers culture and DIY culture that we are now very consciously exploring what it means to make culture and to create culture. And we have seen the kind of resurgence of interest in this idea of enabling people to make things, to, you know, to, from everything from, you know, reskin, you know, digital interfaces so that they reflect meanings that I, you know, that I find interesting and valuable, to opportunities for ways of participating in novel content creation, you know, on different, you know, internet applications or web, kind of web places and so on. So I think there's an interesting kind of moment when from a lot of different perspectives, people are thinking about the logics of the labor of making culture. That it's not, that we don't just make culture kind of incidentally as we go along and live our lives, although we do, but we also make culture very intentionally. And the question is, the question I keep coming back to is, you know, could we make culture intentionally with certain values in mind, values over the long term, like let's leave the planet in a better place ecologically than it is now. How would that value of ecological, sustainability, how would that shape my culture making practices?
Well, yeah, and we're chatting with Dean Alvosamo of the New School for Public Engagement, author of the book Designing Culture, The Technological Imagination at Work on KZCFM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. I want to follow up on that, but my caveat, as I tell my guests, is now we're at the unfair portion of the show. Unfair meaning I'm asking you questions which you may not be able to answer in the time that we have left, but then I ask the question anyway. So it is truly unfair. That is a value that I've instilled into the show over 170 plus shows. When we talk about these values, you know, of course, and you talk about this in the book, that the process of creation needs to itself adhere to certain values. And one of the vexing challenges that you talk about in the book, and it's one that I've discussed a few weeks ago with Biela Coleman regarding her anthropological studies of hackers, is the role of women. And you mentioned at the beginning in terms of your perspective on this area, and now I want to come back to it because you raise this challenge of the relative numbers of women in areas like science and technology, you know, lagging behind men, and I don't want to ask you about that. What is your view, if you have a broad view on this issue, and perhaps, and I don't want to ask you to prognosticate, but perhaps offer any theories you might have on why this problem exists, but let's talk in a sense about numbers and your sense of the scope of the issue, as you talk about in the book.
Okay, and because it is the unfair portion,
yes.
I'm not going to go into statistics or anything. So let's unpack this. Mm-hmm. If you look at the question about women, science, and technology, and that kind of constellation, most times that question is expressed as a question of numbers. And so you want to look at the numbers, you know, and the numbers are based on headcounts of bodies. And as soon as you kind of go down that path, like, okay, let's count the number of female bodies that look to the eye or are identified, self-identified as gendered female, how many do we got? How many do we got in whatever domain? And obviously that question differs greatly across the globe,
mm-hmm.
Because we are in, you know, a very highly technological kind of global moment, and the global workforce in, in other kind of major manufacturing and production places is very different in terms of its gender distribution. So I try to get out of looking at the question of the relationship of women, science and technology as a question of head count, of just counting bodies, because it's different, and the explanations then for the difference are not universal explanations. So we can't say, oh, it's because women don't have a capacity for mathematics or spatial reasoning, because in some educational systems, we actually see parity in the number of women and men trained to be engineers and who go out to perform and be professional engineers and scientists. Okay, so getting out of the headcount gets us out of universal or essentialist kind of understandings to look at the more kind of complex arrangements whereby any single person, you know, gets socialized to pursue one set of questions or over another, or pursue one set of of career aspirations over another, or to persist in a career aspiration over another. I actually like to think about the question of the relationship of women, science, and technology as a question of kind of diversity in the scene of technological innovation. That just as we understand that questions, pressing social need questions that involve technology, require a kind of cross-disciplinary expertise in the design group or the innovation group, because questions of technology are not merely technological questions, but they're also economic questions and policy-related questions and social questions and materials questions and engineering questions and logistics questions, that if you understand that complex contemporary questions having to do with technology require a range of expertise to be brought to bear on the question, then you understand that diversifying the expertise that's in that group is a good thing to do, and that women and minority participants, those who are not kind of representative of the majority kind of identity of engineers and scientists, could bring another set of expertise, another domain or other domains of expertise to the scene of technological innovation. So, and it's not that women, and I try to make this point, women don't bring gender, you know, to the scene of innovation. What they bring is a set of experiences having been socialized as women in contemporary U.S. culture.
You know, and you mentioned in the book as well that, and you've said it here, that it's not just, of course, numbers, but the roles that women play within a given field, which gets to, you know, another point, and again, unfair question. But this connection between the study of technology and the study of innovation on one side and the study of culture. And you make the point, again, I think it ties into, you know, this question of how we engage more people in the process, that those two studies of technology and innovation on one side and culture on the other must be merged. So in a 2 or 3 minute window, why is that merger so essential?
The merger is essential because all technologies are cultural. All technologies have a cultural kind of impact, and all technologies become kind of part of the way in which culture in the future is going to be lived. So there, and the merger and the thinking of the merger is important because all technologies are already enculturated. They are already a part of our contemporary kind of moment, and they are already deeply implicated in the kind of cultural arrangements that will unfold in the future. So we're at this moment where it's kind of time to stop thinking culture versus technology, to understand that culture is inextricably technological, technology is inextricably cultural, and the question I have is, if we start with that, what are the implications that follow from that? And, you know, so one implication is immediately I ask, because I'm an academic and I am interested in, and I work with engineering colleagues all the time, is where in engineering programs do engineering students in training get exposed to this understanding about technology and culture? At what point do they get invited to think about the inextricable nature of technology and culture? Where in their curriculum, at what moment? There's an implication question. Does it happen? And if it does, when? And if it does, with what impact? Or what does it do to the thinking, or how does it manifest in terms of engineering education and socialization.
And, you know, I, of course, I'm asking the dean of a program, so it's always a dangerous question to ask, is it happening at your school? But perhaps I'll ask the question a little more broadly, because I don't want to force you to put anyone on the spot and say X should be doing more or Y is doing great. As a general matter, do you find that in your discussion of this book and of this issue that people who are teaching, who are in the classroom, are becoming more attuned to this issue? Because certainly I think there's a wide range of perspectives on what should, quote unquote, be done or not done in the classroom. What's been your experience there?
My experience in institutional receptivity to, this kind of broad provocation, is that it's uneven across the U.S. And that's the national context that I know the best. I think there are some places that, and I'm now here, I'm talking about engineering schools or schools that have very strong engineering programs. There are some places that are very well poised and are already kind of picking up the question and incorporating questions about social impacts and framing kind of engineering questions in more, what I would call more kind of culturally attuned forms. And I'm going to say, I'll say Stanford's been really interesting. Larry Leifer's work at Stanford has been amazing in forming engineering science, product development, innovation questions that reflect a kind of culturally attuned imagination. I'm not going to call out the places where I think that's a battle that has not been won.
Fair enough. I'll say that for a side interview. Yeah.
I would encourage it, and I know that it can happen, and I know there are colleagues out there who are sympathetic and eager to wonder what this means and how this would impact engineering, product design, education, and so on.
Dean Anna Balsamo, author of the book Designing Culture, The Technological Imagination at Work. I really enjoyed reading it, and the highest compliment I can offer for a book other than having it on my show is that I went back to the at the end notes and started noting sources that I wanted to go to myself, which is always, for a researcher, a high compliment. Anyone who wants to learn more about Anne's work, of course, can go to the website for the New School for Public Engagement at newschool.edu. And thank you for your flexibility again in scheduling and being on the show today. This has been a terrific discussion. I invite you back to continue the discussion as I learned a lot from it, and I also took notes as we were chatting. So thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture and enlightening my audience.
Thanks, Dave. It was a great experience.
Thank you. I'm excited to mention several guests that are coming up in the remaining several weeks of the quarter. I've actually been sick, and my family was under the weather over the last couple of weeks, so that threw off my schedule. But having said that, I'm looking forward to new shows through the rest of the winter quarter on KZSU's schedule. Among the guests coming up are Professor Vance Ricks of Guilford College, talking about social media and the understanding of social media today. Ellen Broad, the Executive Officer of the Australian Digital Alliance, talking about her work both in Australia and internationally on copyright law. Dan Trottier, postdoctoral fellow at Uppsala University, author of the book Social Media as Surveillance. Ron Epstein, CEO of Epicenter Intellectual Property Group on patent non-practicing entities, otherwise known as patent trolls. And Dave Soibert, head of the University of California Santa Barbara's Cylinder Digitization and Preservation Project, of which I'm a huge fan, where you can listen to thousands of digitized cylinders through UCSB's website. As always, you can listen to the show a variety of ways. 9 a.m. Pacific Time Thursdays on KZSU FM Stanford is the live show. You can also stream it if you're not in the Bay Area at kzsulive.stanford.edu. You can also get the show via podcast through the terrific work of Elaine Adolfo at CIS, who puts the show up on CIS's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, or by going to our iTunes page. the iTunes page for the Center for Internet Society, or by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all previous 177-plus shows and take a look at the upcoming schedule. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. Thank you so much for listening today. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a terrific day.